40 years ago, this landmark record brought Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture into America's living rooms. This is the first stereo recording of the overture and the second LP to be released in the Mercury Records Living Presence series of the 1950s. Early hi-fi buffs used to test their equipment with this record. In fact, some still do today. It's also memorable because in addition to the symphony orchestra, it features the sounds of bells and cannon, authentic French cannon from 1812. Wilma Cozart Fine was the pioneering producer when the Living Presence series first came out. She is now supervising the re-release of the entire series onto compact disc and is therefore the best person to define just what Living Presence means.
When you hear one of these recordings, and they do have a very distinctive sound, you feel as though you're actually there. And whenever the first recording of ours made with this technique was released, which was Pictures at an Exhibition back in 1951, Howard Taubman, who was then the music reviewer for the New York Times, wrote that the recording was so realistic that you felt you were in the living presence of the orchestra. And I think he described it just perfectly. And the feeling of excitement and involvement in the recording for you as a listener, I think, is quite strong with these recordings. And so that's why they're called Living Presence recordings.
Now, how were you able to achieve that you are there feeling?
By listening very carefully to be sure that we did hear what we were recording as naturally and as truly to what was happening on the stage as we could possibly do through the use, you know, of microphones and recording equipment. In other words, we listened specifically for that. We wanted you to feel a part of an audience when you were listening.
How did you do it with microphones? I mean, was it one microphone, three microphones?
Well, when we were recording monaurally, which of course we did at the beginning, it was one microphone for that entire orchestra. And by recording in that way, that meant that the dynamic range and all of the nuances of the performance could not be influenced in any way by the engineering, but rather once the microphone was placed, it picked up exactly the performance which the musicians were playing in the auditorium. And whenever we went to stereophonic recording, we recorded on three-track tape, and we used three microphones, one for each of the tracks, and also so that they would cover the entire area of the stage for the stereo effect. And again, we didn't use any control of dynamic range or any, we didn't have a mixing console. We just placed the microphones so that it would reproduce the music as truly as possible, and then recorded it without any change from what the conductor and the musicians were doing during their performance.
Huh. Did this come to somebody in a dream? You know?
Well, that's a very nice way of putting the question. I think everybody wants to do that because, after all, the music is what this is all about. I think that there are many different ways of hearing music. And I think that producers and engineers also hear music in different ways. And so there are many different ways of achieving what this person or that person might think is the absolute reproduction of a performance, but this was what we thought it was. And as I say, the recordings have a very specific personality and sound. And you can usually know when you're listening to one. If you hear it broadcast, many, many people can say, oh, that's a Mercury recording.
Really? They can tell just by listening to it?
Yes, many people can. In fact, many of the people who know the recordings in the catalog well can also know immediately when they hear one of the records or one of the CDs, whether it was recorded in Minneapolis or whether it was recorded in London or just where it was recorded, because the sound of the hall is very much a part of the overall sound of the music, because that's where it's heard.
I want to talk about the latest re-release on CD in the Mercury Living Presence series. And here it is in big black letters on a press release. No matter how many times you've heard the 1812 Overture, you've never heard it like this.
Well, that's true, of course. I don't know what you're going to play, but your listeners may agree when you play it, if you play what I think you're going to.
Oh, you know we're going to play what you think we're going to. We're going to play the recording, 1958, was it?
1958, that's correct.
You tell people what we're listening to.
We're listening to the end of the 1812, where, and the piece was written, of course, to be performed out of doors. And at a given point, the cannons will sound from their position out of doors on the beat to the music, of course, and all of the carillon of the Kremlin will start to ring. It's a very exciting concept. Unfortunately, it wasn't given its first performance that way, but that was the way that it was intended when it was written. And so we have tried to make that come to life on this recording.
Now, this is performed by the Minneapolis Symphony, conducted by Antal Durati. And now, these are real cannons we're listening to here.
They're not only real cannons, which were in the museum at West Point and which were fired for the first time since they were retired, but they are cannons of the period. They're cannons and ammunition for them, which would have been used at the time of that planned original performance. And so they have a very special sound. And the Mercury Living Presence recording of this work and of Wellington's Victory, which is also included on the CD, are the only recordings of those pieces using the authentic weaponry.
What did they say when you went up to West Point and said, listen, I know you haven't shot off these cannons in a while, but we're really interested in recording them for a release we're doing of the 1812. Did they think you were nuts?
Well, I think that they might have thought this was a strange request, but they were very excited about it because, as you can imagine, I think it truly was the dream of the director at that time of the museum at West Point, because he was so helpful in every way to us, because as you can imagine, certainly I knew nothing about firing cannons, and it's not exactly the safest thing you can undertake, and you can't do it just anywhere. So their participation was so important, and Gerald Stowe, who was the curator at that time, was just a dream to work with and knew everything about these weapons, and as a matter of fact helped us also with our recording of music music on the sounds of the Civil War, which we made also, and which is a 2-CD set and tells everything about the Civil War.
How many takes did it take to record the canon? I mean, you certainly didn't get it on the first shot, did you?
I think we did about 20-something altogether. We couldn't do too many because, as I say, the canon had not been fired. Mm-hmm. And at the time, whenever we had the sessions, they had an ambulance standing by and a fire engine standing by, and we were prepared for all kinds of emergencies.
While the recording crew prepared the equipment, black powder was placed in 1- and 2-pound paper bags, and damp newspapers were made up for wadding. Now the ambulance crew is standing by. The signal is given for the first firing. Well, that sounded very good. But we decided to try again, using more gunpowder and altering the microphone position slightly. That was not so good. Did you hear that tinny ringing in the background? Further microphonic adjustments were made while the crew swabbed out the cannon. Once again now. Still that tinny sound. What could it be? Well, after some searching, a huge oil tank was located several yards from the left microphone, and it was the vibrations of that tank that were being picked up. The tank certainly looked too big to move, but the cadets rallied round and finally managed to roll the giant barrel down a hillside.
So the challenge for you was then making sure you had your microphone at the right place to record the exact sound that you wanted.
Oh, that's correct, yes.
And that must have been a real challenge.
Well, it's an interesting thing. This CD contains the two of the most famous battle pieces in the entire symphonic repertoire, the 1812 Overture and Beethoven's Wellington's Victory. And as difficult as the 1812 was, and it was difficult for us because it was the first one of this type thing which we had done, but the Wellington's Victory is much more complicated because it has also many more shots, and you had to have a French cannon and an English cannon, again, of the period, and they had to fire at each other, whereas in the 1812, there are only 19 cannon shots, whereas there are 194 cannon shots, which have to be placed on the beat of the music in the Wellington's Victory.
Now, I don't want to neglect the bells here.
Yes.
Where did you find the bells?
Well, we went to the Laura Spellman Rockefeller Carillon, which is in the Riverside Church on Riverside Drive here in New York. And they're high up in a bell tower there, and they have the largest tuned bell in the world there, so you get a wonderful low bass resonance, and then they also have beautiful high bells and beautiful middle range bells, and all of that, and I cannot quite describe to you what it's like to be up in the bell tower when all of those are pealing and looking out across the Hudson and over at the Palisades across the way. You just aren't apt to be anywhere else in the world ever, which sounds quite like that. It was really marvelous.
I bet it was. I'm wondering if you were wearing at some point some... I know you had to hear what was going on, but oh...
Well, whenever the carillonneur was ringing them, you just had to stand there and hope your microphones were doing what they were supposed to do, because you also, we had to get special permission to ring them, because the bells up at the Riverside Church are played only at specific times and for specific reasons. And if you just started this, all of this clamor without some sort of explanation to the neighborhood, because they can be heard for such a long way, you know, that it might, people wouldn't know what to think. And that, as a matter of fact, we ended our session because so many calls were coming into the switchboard of the church, you know, why are the carol on pealing and all of, and they did, they, we didn't get the, you couldn't get the message out quite that much since it was not an emergency, which could be broadcast or something. But, well, you know, we were able to get the effect that we thought we needed, and then take it back and work with it and get, try to duplicate the sounds as they are described from that particular time in Moscow.
Wilma Cozart-Fine, thanks so much for joining us.
It was a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.